Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Ross Laird podcast. And now we listen in to Mick Wallace and Claire Daly as they discuss what's happening in Europe.
Bonjour, comment allez-vous? I'm Aoife, here in Brussels for work experience with Claire and Mick.
Brilliant. Yeah, and very welcome you were too. It was a pleasure to have you. And just in case you're deceived by her perfect French, tell us a bit about how you're so good at French.
I live in Paris in France.
And your Irish connection is?
Oh yeah, and my my granny and granddad live in Wexford.
Would they know any Wallaces by any chance?
Yes, my granny is Mick's sister.
Well, and we say hello. We say hello to Granny Chrissy then at the start of the show. A listener, an avid listener. What do you think, Mick?
Chrissy, your sister, my granny. I have my doubts now. But then, listen, I've been reprimanding Tina as well. Tina is Aoife's mother, Chrissy's daughter. And don't think she's been listening to the podcast the whole lot either, you know. But
someone who has been listening, though, is Damien's father.
That's true.
So we didn't send him wishes last week.
Just coming out of the hospital today. So okay. Give him a big hug from the podcast.
Big greetings. We hope that just because he's out of hospital now doesn't mean that he has too much time not to listen to the podcast. So,
hopefully he started good habits.
Yes.
But then you'll find now he's probably only listening to the podcast when Damien is on it.
He's terribly disappointed when I'm not on it.
Okay.
Anyway, that was a wonderful bonjour to kick off the show. I've never heard such a nice bonjour on this show before. So we have loads to get through today. We're going to be talking a bit about Ukraine and the war and the food and fuel angle. And you'll see there's a lot of talk about shipping grain out of Ukraine and the challenges there. Maybe we start there, Claire. We just had a meeting there and the Russia delegation discussing this issue.
Grain is where it's at, like, and this issue has featured. It featured on the Transport Committee earlier in the week. It featured on the Russia delegation and it featured at the Draw Human Rights Committee as well, because the impact on the Global South. So basically, the story is, I suppose, that Ukraine, as one of the biggest grain producers, used to export about 5 million tonnes a month, which was necessary for the global economy, Europe and the rest. Europe's probably okay. It's going to have a much bigger impact on areas outside of Europe and the potential of destabilising whole areas of the global site. So there's a blockade on. As part of the war, the Russians have a blockade along the ports on the Black Sea. They can't get the grain out there. That was the way they used to get it out. So they're working night and day to get it out in a different way. Now, I thought it was really interesting during the TRAN committee, because the representative came in from the commission, sort of made the point that, look, we got 2 million out, which is up now in the last month, and we're aiming for 3. And we're developing this whole network to get it out across other member states. But we're moving swiftly to integrate Ukraine into the EU economy. Now, people ask, kind of going, well, look, if you want to get the grain out in a hurry, like, would it not be an idea maybe to sort of start negotiations with the Russians, quid pro quo, ye release a bit here, we'll give you something back there, such as the urgency of the food. Would you not talk to Belarus or that? But no. And this came up with the Russia delegation as well. If you want to unblock the port, you've got to talk to the Russians. And it was very clear from the Agricultural Committee that the problem to that is they're saying that it's the Ukrainian government and that their sovereignty has to be respected. But it's the Ukrainians who are saying, no, don't talk to the Russians. There's no point in that. Now, our attitude here will be there's always a point in talking. And if you want to get the grain out, you've got to get talking. So that was a bit worrying. And I mean, we put to the EEAS, the External Action Services, about these claims of Russians stealing grain and so on, that what was the basis of their assertion that this was happening? And because they were going on about Russian disinformation, and I said, well, look, the Russians are definitely doing disinformation. So in that context, we have to have evidence for everything we say. So can you give us the examples, the numbers, the locations, the sources of your claims, because the Russians deny it? And it was pathetic. Like, your man got back and he said, yes, I certainly can. The Ukrainians told us and we have to respect that. It's Ukrainian information. Now, I mean, come on. That's not independently verified. Like, are they saying then that Ukraine don't do disinformation as well? That all information from Ukraine is right because they're the goodies. All information from Russia is bad because they're the baddies. That's pathetic.
Oh, yeah. There's it's it seems to be getting a bit madder. But at the same time, I think there's a threat of sanity creeping in. There's a lot of problems. I had, I think I had about three battles this week on this same issue. One of them was with Mairead McGuinness, and because she's actually the commissioner related to some of the economic element that's tied to sanctions. And I put a few things to Mairead about the fact that, look what I said, I admitted that the Ukraine's export restrictions due to Russia's invasion has had a massive impact on global food supplies. But I said, so have the EU sanctions. It is outrageous that they can try, that they're kind of trying to say that all the problem is to do with the war and that the sanctions have nothing to do with it. The sanctions are having an impact. And I quoted her, the UN General Secretary, General Guterres, when last week he said, there's really no true solution to the problem of global food security without bringing back the agriculture production of Ukraine and the food and fertilizer production of Russia and Belarus into world markets despite the war. And the African Union said that our countries are very worried about the collateral impact of the disruptions caused by the blocking of the SWIFT payment system as a result of sanctions. And I pointed out to her, I said, the sanctions have not stopped the war. The sanctions will not stop the war. And I said, Russia actually has, while Ukraine's grain is production of wheat is massive and very important, don't forget that that Russia actually produces and exports almost three times more than Ukraine of grain, of wheat. Now, that's phenomenal, right? And obviously, Russia and Belarus completely dominate the fertilizer market. And there was good reason why the Global South didn't vote for sanctioning Russia at the UN, because they depend on them.
I mean, this is the saddest thing, that the people paying the price, and the Russia delegation and the other ones were all their analysis. Oh, it's nothing to do with the sanctions, it's the war, which is completely not the case and is totally naive. But it's sad to think that it's the people who have outside of Europe who are going to even pay the biggest price on this. I mean, there were reports this week from the UN that maybe 350,000 Somalis are going to, people in Somalia are going to die of hunger by the end of the summer. The overwhelming majority of them children. We dealt with the topic last week of Afghanistan, where 10 million people will only be serviced by the World Food Programme when 20 million people urgently need assistance. And of the ones that they are supporting, they can only give them 50% of their calorific needs. So I think there's nearly six countries now in a famine situation. So this is lunacy. And it doesn't even make sense. And I think your point is good, Mick, about Russia, because we had this sort of news entering the fray yesterday about the six Russian ships that were allowed to land in Ireland. And Ireland, of course, being a very good boy and girl in class at imposing sanctions. How could this be that Russian ships could land with grain for animal feed? And of course, there was an exemption, an absolute necessity they needed, because Irish agriculture would be absolutely floored if they don't get this. And they got it and they allowed the ships docked, and we've no problem with that. That's very, very good. But it sort of undermines this argument that, oh, there's no point talking to the Russians. Well, of course you can do business with the Russians. Ireland had to do it yesterday. And the rest of the world probably will. And if you're easing into dialogue and, well, you release this here and we'll give you that back there, well, that's the only way to get things back to a resolution, rather than saying, oh, no, we're not talking to them now because they started it. I mean, that's only going to just scare people.
It was sickening listening to Mairead's reply, which was totally black and white, twisted what I had been saying and went on a rant. Just an anti-Russian rant playing to the gallery, and she got an applause from the vast majority of MEPs in there.
Well, one thing she did is she made her question about a different thing, because you are asking about the impact the sanctions have on Europeans as well, and about the cost of living crisis and also the broader cost, the hunger crisis across the world. And then she of course brought it back to this whole thing, like you said earlier, Claire, about it just being squarely Russia's fault, that what we're doing is morally right and everything, and that what we're doing isn't having any impact, but it's due to the war.
It is a total lie.
Which is a simple way of looking at it, but it's a bit more complex than that. Like you say, there's things you can do, there's things we have to do, but that's it.
It is a lie to say that the sanctions are having no impact on global food prices. It's a lie that sanctions are not having an impact on inflation across the whole of Europe. Inflation in Europe is going to be close to 10% this year. It's already gone over 8%. It's going to have a massive impact on living standards in Europe. Not just on energy, and but also on food, and there'll be other things to follow. Right? And we're introducing sanctions that, and I put it to her that they're going to hurt the people of Europe, and they're going to starve people in the global south, and it's going to have a much bigger impact than they'll ever have on Putin's government. That's the fight.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, you made the point earlier that I think the cracks are beginning to emerge, and I think they are, like, there has to be quarters, and there is around the world, who are saying if this keeps going on the route they're going, there is going to be consequences beyond anything imaginable in terms of the implications in the global south, and then the blowback of that back on the EU and so on. But I noticed as well in the discussion, certainly in the transport sector, that the European Commission were much more interested in using this crisis to integrate Ukraine into the European transport network rather than dealing with the problem of the grain. And one of the things was that we need to get buyers and we need to get storage. They're our biggest problems at the moment. And I'm kind of going, well, sorry, Manel, given that there's a massive global need, why would you need storage? Because, like, there's millions of people who actually need this stuff now. And if they can't buy it, it's because they can't bloody well afford to buy it. So what are you doing to address that? And one of her things was, well, we're working really hard. We're trying to get the World Food Programme to buy Ukrainian grain. Your woman says, well, you know, believe it or not, she said, before the war, the World Food Programme used to buy a third of the Ukrainian grain. She said, now they haven't sent a single ship and we need to address this. Like I said, sorry now. The reason why they haven't sent a single ship is no one is giving them any money because you're too busy using your money on aid to arms manufacturers. You're not giving any money to the countries like Afghanistan and the World Food Program who needed to feed people. There's a, it's madness. Like,
yeah, I mean, I don't know if we mentioned it last week, but the World Food Program has highlighted the fact that they made an appeal for money that they need to help feed 20 million people in Afghanistan. And they said that they only got one third of the money they need. They're literally letting people go hungry. And a terrible quote from the head of the World Food Programme, he said, we are taking food from the hungry to give to the starving. I mean, and the European Union can will bend over backwards to spend on arms for Ukraine and cannot feed the people of a country that they helped to destroy for 20 years. And as Claire pointed out, the Americans were spending $300 million a day for 20 years in Afghanistan, destroying the place. And now they can't come up with 2 weeks of that money to feed them and keep them alive.
What are people saying here now in the parliament in terms of the sanctions on Afghanistan as this situation is developing and becoming a lot graver? Like there was a meeting this morning on Afghanistan as well that you're both at in terms of the food crisis. Do you think anything in terms of unblocking the money or the sanctions is going to change, or do you think there's
the truth is that you have a British bank, a German bank, and a Swiss bank freezing money belonging to Afghanistan, but the vast majority of it is frozen in America, and the British and German and Swiss will not release it until the Americans tell them they can. We do what we're told now. The EU has lost any notion of sovereignty it had. We've become an absolute puppet of the Americans. And that's why the US-NATO agenda is paramount around this Russia-Ukraine war up to now. But listen, if that doesn't change, right, we're digging a hole for ourselves and the Americans are laughing. The Americans are buying oil off the Russians still, right? And they're telling everyone else not to buy it, right? I mean, how long are we going to behave in such a stupid manner, actually damaging our own interest to facilitate the interest of US NATO? How long is this going to go on for?
I mean, the UN Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan was in and he gave a report, and then the Special Ambassador for the EU spoke and people from the External Action Services, and we were quite critical of, I suppose the emphasis was on putting a lot of responsibility on the Taliban for all of the problems. And there's no doubt about it, the Taliban would not be any friends of ours. They'd be completely on the different end of the spectrum to us. But they have taken over a country where overnight, basically 75% of the economic resources have disappeared. So it doesn't matter who you are, you can't run a country like that. And you can talk all you like about women going to work and girls going to school and everybody being respected and law and order. If people aren't fed and they haven't got stability, everything else is secondary to that, you know, and they need support for that. So they are desperately needing support. And the only way of addressing that is by lifting the sanctions. And they were very cautious. They all know that that's the case and they acknowledge that, but they're not demanding that or they're not enforcing it. And they need to, you know.
But isn't it shocking, though, that the MEPs here in the Parliament have lost interest in Afghanistan, where there's millions hungry, and they can't get enough of the war in Ukraine. And yet, we bear a huge responsibility for the destruction of the people in Afghanistan. And now we don't want to even talk about them.
Well, what I think is gas as well. Like, they talk about us being Democrats versus authoritarian regimes. And we have these delegations in the parliament. So we're both on the Afghanistan delegation, which is supposed to be fraternal links with that country. But the truth is, since the Taliban took over, the work of that committee has basically slowed down. The number of ordinary meetings has massively shrunk. And the rules of the parliament means that it's only the president of that delegation who can convene a meeting. So even though there's a secretariat...
And I'm the first vice president.
So even though there's a secretariat who are there to, you know, assist the meetings, even though there's members who want to go to the meetings, if the chair doesn't want to convene a meeting, nobody can do anything about that. And the chair at the moment is somebody who actually went to the Irish Times and quoted about us and our role here. But actually, he's a NATO-sponsored individual from Lithuania who is much more interested in dealing with stuff. He's in Ukraine or parroting sort of anti-Belarus, anti-Russian rhetoric morning, noon and night, and has no interest clearly in Afghanistan.
He actually came into a committee about 18 months ago and he boasted about being at a NATO meeting in London at the weekend. He boasted about it. And then he presents himself as an independent opinion here.
And we're happy to work with him. But if he doesn't want to work, move over and we'll do the work. But don't block the work. That's what he's basically doing. He's entitled to his opinion. We've no problem with that. And we've no problem with working with him. Mm. Don't stop us from working on it, because that's what he's doing.
But do you know what now? I mean, given we often talk about the disconnect between the people and the politicians, right? And it's actually been borne out by the European Council on Foreign Relations report. They've done a very widespread survey in most of the countries in Europe, sadly not Ireland, for some reason. And they put questions to the people, right, in the different countries, right? And, like, for example, they asked them, what do you think our priority should be, peace or punishing the Russians? And just to give you a flavour of it, right, but in every country in Europe that they surveyed, in the EU, the only one who favoured punishing the Russians over peace was Poland. And I find that amazing that there's such a feeling among the public in Europe, despite the mainstream media being cheerleaders for the war from day one, and they can't get enough of it. There's so much in the US NATO camp. Yet, the people are giving their call for peace. And Italy, for example, right? Just to give you an idea. Italy, it was 3-1 in favour of peace over punishing the Russians. But every country in Europe, except Poland, favoured peace ahead of trying to punish the Russians. And even just in Germany, right, they asked all the German parties, right, and in total in Germany, right, it was also, it was 2.5 times more in favour of peace than punishing the Russians. And they surveyed the four parties in Germany, right, as to who wanted peace the most. and Alternative for Deutschland, 80% of them went for peace. The Social Democrats, well over 50% against 22 went looking for punishing Russia. The CDU-CSU coalition, it was almost 2-1 in favour of peace. And the only one that was a tight call were the Greens, who just barely favoured peace above punishing the Russians. They were the
well,
most...
You wouldn't think it to listen to the people here.
What?
You wouldn't think it to... Well, listen to their people here, you'd be thinking that not, 100% of them were in favour of punishing the Russians.
They were the worst in this
they're
survey.
Still, yeah, yeah. Of course they are. They're worse in here as well.
And another question that was put to them, what are your biggest concerns in regard to the war in Ukraine? And the biggest concern was the increase in cost of living and energy prices. And my last one I'll give you is, right, there's loads more, but I've just picked out four. Should your country spend more on defence now given the war in Ukraine? Only two countries said so.
Poland. And Lithuania. Estonia.
Poland and Sweden, believe it or not. Mm. Right?
Always a bit dodgy, yeah. Well, big military industry there, of course. I mean, they'd be money hot home, money for jam.
It just goes to show that the people are on a different wavelength to the politicians and the governments.
Yeah, well, you'd be wondering, it is interesting that as we sit here today, Macron, Draghi and Schultz are the three of them together on their way to meet Zelensky, which is interesting that they're going and having a meeting themselves with them. Obviously, they're coming out with a nice bit of sort of hardline, you know, anti-Russian rhetoric. Fair enough, Russia started the war, but it is interesting that they're going there, and it'll be very interesting to see what they're saying to them, because reading between the lines of some of the stuff been coming out with Biden and that, where Biden kind of made this big public statement about how Zelensky had ignored their warnings about Russia, it seemed to me that the Americans were trying to pressure Zelensky and the Ukrainians, and there seems to be a lot of that going on, that they don't want them to sit down and negotiate an end to this. It's very clear that they're being hammered militarily, even with the curtain. And it's appalling to see the pummeling of areas, the destruction of residential areas by the Russian artillery, keeping those troops there. As we said from the beginning, not with any, you know, pleasure or anything. It will be an impossibility for Ukraine to stand up to the might of the Russian army. It's just not going to happen, and that is not going to happen. And the sooner this war is ended, the better. But maybe sense is beginning to prevail. I don't know. But
I would also say that listen to some of the talk at some of the meetings this week on security and defence in particular, and some of the foreign affairs stuff. There's been a lot of talk about the council meeting from the 30th and 31st of May. Seemingly, it was very interesting. Now, unfortunately, as we pointed out to people before, the council is one of the three institutions here. We have the Parliament, the Council, and we have the Commission. And all the council would be more powerful than the Parliament, from what I can see. But their meetings are all held in secret. But there's been a good bit of stuff come out of the meeting. And it was pointed out that under the pretext of highlighting European defence, the conclusions adopted by the 27 heads of states and governments meeting in Brussels at the end of May, they were conveying a subtle message as well. And it says it is above all up to the states to define the future of the European defence and not the European Commission. And what they were really saying, that the council seems to be addressing all those tempted by this communitarisation of defence policy. The Commission and the Parliament are trying to tie in all these different elements of our defence policy, try and coordinate them a bit more, get more money into all of them and give them more power and clout, right? But the council seems to have a different idea, right? And it's kind of accused the Commission of being tempted to widen their field of action. And what they're saying is that their competence is fixed in the treaty and they should be respected. So I'm not so sure that the Commission are going to be allowed to do quite as much as they've been planning. And obviously, with the likes of Macron and Schultz heading off to Ukraine, it's going more or less as the leaders of Germany and France, not as the leaders of the European Union.
Yeah, of course.
Which could be
Move on to this important vote that took place on Tuesday on related to sustainable finance in the EU. There's what's called a delegated act, which is where the Commission drafts up a big set of rules. It's not negotiated between the Parliament and Council. The Commission takes care of the whole thing and the Parliament has a veto on it. This is the EU Taxonomy Delegated Act. So the problem with it, what makes it so controversial, is that it's adding natural gas activities and nuclear activities into the sustainable investment framework so they can get a green categorization for investments in these activities, calling them sustainable activities. So it's been a really polemic issue here in the Parliament. And there was an objection brought forward by the Parliament, which both of you are signatories of. And it's going to be voted now in July at the plenary with all of the MEPs. But Mick, you were in the committee there on Tuesday voting on this. There was 76 votes in favour, 62 against and 4 abstentions. So it passed with a bit of a margin. Seen as a big defeat for Commissioner McGuinness, who is the commissioner responsible for this, who has been going around for months now trying to promote this taxonomy. I don't know whose interest she's representing, but she's been the biggest proponent of it now, and she must be disappointed. But we'll see what happens in July with the big plenary vote. But what did you make of how things went?
Yeah, I thought the vote would be closer as well. Now, I don't know whether it had an impact or not, but at the last minute before we voted, the previous decision to make it a roll call vote where everyone's vote would be registered and become public, that was lifted.
It was withdrawn from the...
So in other words, it became a secret vote, really.
Yeah.
Rather than a public vote. Do you think that had an impact on the result?
Yeah, I think lots of MEPs, especially in the centre and right, are quite afraid of a big lobbying campaign from now until July, where the plenary vote will take place. There's a lot of national interests at play here. There's lots of pro-nuclear countries, lots of anti-nuclear countries, and it doesn't really go along political lines sometimes. So you'll see, for example, in Austria, every single Austrian MEP will vote in favour of objecting to this inclusion of nuclear, especially the nuclear aspect as a green activity. None of them are having any of it, from the ID, EPP, any of the groups. Look at other countries such as Poland. They're all in favour of this because it's green in gas. But there's also been studies done showing how the big beneficiary of it all is France. And there's going to be very little money going towards Eastern European countries because none of them are actually going to qualify for the criteria that's set out in this delegated act. So even though they're big fans of it, they're actually going to get nothing out of it. And also, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens at the vote because it's very unpredictable. It's hard to know how things will go. As you said, the vote wasn't registered. We don't know how the other Irish MEPs voted, for example.
Well, I think they've made it public that that they were in favour of McGuinness's position and wanting nuclear and gas included in the taxonomy. But what I found interesting as well was that some people were saying that, including gas and nuclear in the taxonomy would be a blow to Putin. And then I heard people voting the opposite way, saying the same. So some people think that, well, listen, obviously Europe does need to wean itself off Russian gas and we should have done it long ago. And they wouldn't be in such a predicament now if they had. Mm. But the idea that, of course, we need to become more sustainable. And so gas should not be allowed in the taxonomy and classified as green with nuclear. But then on the opposite side, some people think that because of the war, that we're in a difficult place now and we might have to park some of these environmental things. And you know what now? Even though we don't want Russian gas, we're going to want to get it elsewhere and we're going to be using a lot of gas for a long while still. And we're probably going to need a bit more money now to invest in new infrastructure for gas. Like, for example, in dealing with LNG, imported LNG, because it has to be processed when it arrives.
Yeah.
So you need to build these LNG plants to deal with it. And if gas is in the taxonomy, then the people building them are going to get access to cheaper money through the European Investment Bank.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, like, and when you look at it from an Irish perspective, it's just mad to be supporting it. We have no nuclear. I don't know why Mairead McGuinness is on a big campaign now as well to get this included. And there's only one green category, so it's going to be seen as a sustainable investment just as much as investment in renewables will be. Do you know, it's actually messing up the whole sustainable finance taxonomy, which is supposed to help us divert money in towards sustainable activities. And it's now going to be confusing the whole thing. And then we have gas. So Ireland isn't going to be getting any money from that as well, because it depends on certain criteria.
Oh, well, hold on a minute now. Right. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are in favour, as far as I can see, of the gas and nuclear being included in the taxonomy for business reasons. But on the gas issue, right, would you not be a little bit concerned that Shannon LNG will raise its head again?
Oh, it certainly will, but I don't think because of the taxonomy, but because of the Repower EU plan from the Commission, which is to wean off Russian gas and oil. Great, we're all for that. But to expand LNG massively. And that's why we have a delegation of Saudis over in the parliament walking around. There's all sorts. That Ursula von der Leyen was in Israel there the other day trying to build up links on energy. And of course, the Americans, they literally say these three constituencies, they want to expand LNG imports. Okay, and now there's big pressure on the government to reverse the programme for government on LNG.
OK, but I mean, my question is, if the government reversed their position on LNG and again went and built a plant in the Shannon Estuary, would it avail of cheap finance from the European Investment Bank if gas is included in taxonomy?
It wouldn't be taxonomy compliant still, because it would be an LNG terminal, and this is related to the burning.
So it still wouldn't qualify. Right, your point,
but
about
that's still very problematic when you look at, and it also requires to be moving from coal or oil towards a facility that's moving from coal or oil to gas. So there's still some very serious criteria in this financing, but the problem is it's still expanding gas, and there's still going to be new gas infrastructure built in other member states. So there's going to be big losers in this and big winners. You're going to see money going towards Finland, who have a very advanced nuclear, for instance, and you're going to see very little money going towards Ireland and other countries. So it's very complicated, but in the end of the day, it's still about greenwashing gas and greenwashing nuclear, and that's what the choice is. Do we want to ruin our sustainable taxonomy and pollute it with these activities, or do we want to keep it clean and simple and usable?
You were mentioning, Damien, about Israel, right? It's funny now, but that actually came up at one of my committees this week, right? Commissioner Verheyen was in, and he was actually he was talking about a great deal that the European Union was doing at the moment, and they were hoping to get across the line, and it was about buying liquid natural gas from Israel, who cannot liquefy it seemingly, but it was going to go to Egypt. It would be liquefied in Egypt, and then it would go to Europe. Now, I don't know where the Israelis are getting it, but that'd be interesting too. They're probably robbing off somebody.
Anyway, that's the big vote. We'll see how everyone votes in July. Let's talk a bit about Catalonia, Claire.
Yeah, no, we were very happy that the EU-Catalan dialogue has reconvened this week. This is obviously like an informal network that we're involved in with a number of colleagues. Obviously, our earlier work pre-COVID involved going to visit the Catalan leaders who were in prison. Clearly, we have a number of members of the European Parliament who were sanctioned for their role in the pro-independence vote in Catalonia a number of years ago. I suppose the reason for, well, we wanted all meetings are coming back in person now, which is great. I mean, the Parliament is abuzz with people left, right and centre, but this was the first time we'd had a chance to have a meeting. And the two issues that we were discussing were the present situation in Spain with negotiations and the repression against Catalans, where it's still the case that about 3,000 citizens are being pursued, journalists, lawyers, business people, politicians, over various spurious claims going back to that. So they have litigation hanging over them, which is incredibly repressive. The nine people, two women, seven men, who were imprisoned, political leaders, they got a pardon when the socialist government came to power. But they haven't had an amnesty, so they can't work in any public life. They can't get any money from a job where the state will be funding it. So one of the ministers was a professor in the college. You can't work in the college. You can't get any state funding. So huge repression continuing. But the big news story was then the Pegasus software. Now, people probably have vaguely heard of this, so I won't go into it too much, but the NSO, an Israeli company, developed this Pegasus software, which can essentially take over your computer devices, your phones or whatever. They prey on the vulnerabilities in the systems, be it iPhones, Androids, and literally the technology then takes over your phone. It's obviously highly illegal. The Israeli firm produces, and they're only allowed to sell it to states, allegedly, you know. But there has been an acknowledgement that the Spanish state has been involved in this. And the biggest revelation of the use of Pegasus software is that it's been installed on the phones of at least 65 Catalans, lawyers, business people, politicians. And the technology takes over your whole phone. It means even if you were attending a meeting which required encryption to attend, they can get into that. They can take over your phone and your voice, your recording. So they can be an active surveillance of you with your own phone and your own voice message without you even knowing. And this technology is widespread. There's actually a special committee in the parliament convened to discuss it because it's highly anti-democratic. But the Spanish authorities refused to investigate it. I mean, initially they said, this is a big smear, we are not involved in this, nothing to do with us. Then they said, well, okay, there was a bit of it, but we had judicial permission, even though the lack of independence of the Spanish judiciary is a whole other argument, which the European Commission don't care about. But then they said, okay, we did a few, but we did them legally. But no, we're not looking into it any further, which the biggest point here is that we constantly hear talk about the EU is in a battle of democracies against authoritarian regimes, and countries like Spain would parrot that rubbish. And here you have an old embedded EU member state with a lack of an independent judiciary, widespread surveillance of political opponents, and nobody doing anything about it, not to mind the suppression of their civil rights, deprivation of their liberty and so on. So I suppose we kind of, it was nice to get back in person with people across all the political groups who are involved. And I suppose we have 2 years left in the mandate. We need to up our game on how we pressurise Spain to come to a negotiated solution to the situation in Catalonia.
No, it's funny when you think of Pegasus and everything, like, it just shows you how crazy, undemocratic and insane it is, going around hacking people's phones, getting politically interfering and everything like this. And I was just looking at Ursula von der Leyen's tweets. Now, she had one saying, the reality of Russian occupation of Ukraine is terrifying. And then she has one, very happy to be in Israel. Let's work together to strengthen further the European-Israeli partnership. Now, there's a little bit of a weird interpretation of European values there when we're talking about standing up on one end, but then strengthening a partnership where we know there's an apartheid state there. We know that what they're doing as well in terms of complicity with this kind of hacking. And we have Ursula von der Leyen paraded over there to go deepen ties even further.
Well, it's funny how information shifts, because it was well known and acknowledged. And it's true that up to about five, everybody knows that these softwares and these vulnerable were exploited by Israel primarily and the US. And everybody knows that, undisputed. But history has been rewritten now, whereas it's China and Russia doing all of this. Where actually China and Russia are just catching up. We're not saying anybody should be doing it, but they're just catching up. Everybody knows the other started it, whereas the whole thing should be ended, really.
And which brings us back to the whole area of disinformation. I mean, who tells the truth? I mean, we make the argument all the time that every country engages in disinformation in one form or another. And the idea that only the others do it is total nonsense.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I mean, we had a meeting of what we were going to do. So the Disinformation Committee, Inga 2, is back in business. And we had our first meeting the other day of the coordinators to decide our work. But they've gone completely mad. Like, one of the lads, one of his topics he wanted on it was the fact that Italian MP or whatever leader of the Liga had a meeting with the Russian embassy, and that the Italian government didn't know about that, and he was going to go on a trip to Moscow, and they wanted a big session in the European Union. This was an example of Russian interference. I said, this isn't Russian interference. This is an Italian politician deciding to meet an ambassador in his country. Now, whether that was politically correct or not for him, the people who elected him will judge on that. But how is that political interference by Russia? Like, it was a decision taken by an elected member of parliament in Italy. And what's got to do with the European Parliament? Absolutely nothing, you know.
Would the fact that the Americans tell us what to do morning, noon and night, and that we can do bugger all now without their permission, could we argue that the Americans are interfering in European politics? I think we could.
No, but I mean, they had another one then that MEPs were being given out because some of the Turkish authorities had criticised members of the European Parliament, named them, accused them of being terrorists or whatever, and they were all up in arms about this was outrageous. They wanted a special meeting on this Turkish interference. I'm going, sorry, what's the interference? Was this a bit of abuse on Twitter led by Turkish politicians? Yeah, it was, yeah. And I said, well, that's, you know, disgusting, and their language and their improper conduct and what they'd accused the MEPs of was terrible. But it's not foreign interference. I mean, there's people give out about me on Twitter, and foreign politicians do as well. Am I going to get a special session on me? Like, I mean, the same MEPs who were being criticised by the Turks were themselves always criticising Turkey, but that's okay. They can criticise politicians and accuse them of everything in Turkey, but when the Turks do the same thing, then that's a big problem, and it's foreign interference. I mean, this is ridiculous. It
reminds me of the plenary last week when we had a debate on the threatened rollback on abortion rights in America, and so people got up and said, how dare we interfere in the domestic affairs of America? How dare we talk about America in here? They're a sovereign state. And I got up and I said, hold on a minute. I said, we talk about everybody else. We talk about everybody. Why are we not going to talk about the Americans? I said, what country do we not talk about? I mean, and that is the point you were making, Claire, as well. We accuse the Chinese of doing things and saying things that they shouldn't do. And I mean, the rhetoric, the anti-China rhetoric in the European Parliament is scary. And are we interfering in Chinese affairs, I wonder?
I thought there was really interesting information about China there in the Transport Committee this morning. So people will know that obviously the Chinese economy is still kind of locked down. So that's had an impact on global aviation. There's no flights, passenger flights travelling in or out of China. Well, hardly any, like, you know. But interestingly, their cargo transport is flying merrily over the Russian airspace and getting to Europe or America or wherever it's going, 2.5, 3 hours, 4 hours shorter than European cargo that wants to go to China, that's going all the way around, taking hours of extra hours to respect the sanctions. So there's no need for it. The Chinese are happily just going through the airspace because they're not implementing the sanctions. All the European ones are, and it's having an impact on our, obviously, our services, on our crew. They have to work longer hours, then they go out of flight times, then that means there's less staff to go around, which is contributing to the chaos that we're seeing across in European airports and the environmental footprint. It's just absolutely ludicrous. And when we asked the Eurocontrol about this, they said, look, I said, is this not shooting ourselves in the foot here now? I said, because Chinese are having a great time. The Russians don't seem to be that bothered about it either. And then we're the ones paying. And he says, oh, well, look at it now. He said, Everyone has to suffer, he said. We realise that. But there has to be solidarity with Ukraine.
And everyone includes
the environment. What does that even mean, you know?
Everyone happens to include the environment.
Yeah.
Because can you think of all the extra fuel being used?
Yeah.
Does anyone give a damn?
Yeah. Oh, mad place.
I think we got through the most part of what we're supposed to do today.
We have to leave the last word to Aoife.
Yeah, will you take us off there, Aoife?
Well, I'll tell you what, now, I'm going to ask her a couple of questions, right?
Okay.
Now, first, just, you were at a lot of the committees this week, right?
Yes.
What did you find most interesting?
I really liked the committee about Antarctica. We were talking about the fishing that was happening in Antarctica. Okay, so while they were talking about the marine protected areas,
yeah,
and how there was a lot of countries that fished around Antarctica and how they wanted to put in marine protected areas, and how China and Russia were against these marine protected areas.
Yeah, I mean, but we didn't get any clarity on, as to why the Russians and Chinese were opposing them. I think it's something we should look into, because the people that were looking for them obviously were fishing in other areas, and they wanted to protect the fish stocks and make sure that there was plenty of fish for them to catch in the areas that they were fishing in. But now, whether the Russians and the Chinese are behaving badly down there, I don't know. But it is mad to think that nobody owns the place. That's incredible. And but there was an agreement, the Antarctic Agreement of 1959, where there are seven countries in particular kind of carved it up for themselves and says, oh, this is our area, this is our zone, this is our zone. They kind of cut it up like a bit of a pizza, but they never actually, they were never given right to it anywhere. And it's very good that there's one thing they have agreed on all the time since 1959 is a mining ban. Mm. So there's no mining allowed in the Antarctica, and it would be a disaster if there was. The same as we're really worried that there's going to be a lot of mining in the Arctic, which is closer to us. But it is so important that the Antarctic and Arctic are left untouched in terms of mineral exploitation. Was there anything else that you found interesting?
I found all the committees interesting, but that one was my favourite so far.
Okay.
Cool. And I suppose we should end by saying that obviously, as Aoife is a Parisienne and a French citizen, as well as an Irish and an English one as well, as I told her, she's more passports than a Ukrainian oligarch, that we shouldn't end the programme without mentioning actually the French elections, because an incredible outcome for the broad left assembled under the leadership of Mélenchon, from the leader of La France Insoumise, who are in our group in the European Parliament, but an incredible outcome in the first round. So your family were happy with that, I think, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, and we'll a lot of people in France got a really jot. So they pulled together a coalition of socialists and environmentalists and everybody kind of loosely, very loosely, some of them on the left, but there's the possibility that they could get maybe 150, 200 seats. Maybe that's ambitious, but they've already got huge numbers. Good chance, they ran neck and neck with Macron, which was just powerful. Really, really interesting. And
they were actually very close in the presidential election as well. They nearly got second spot, and they'd have been in the runoff with Macron, but Le Pen got it. But Mélenchon would have given Macron a real run for his money in head-to-head in the second round of the presidential election. It was just a pity he didn't get those extra 2%.
And there's a lesson in it, like, because there's often talk about left unity and the left sort of killing each other and all that kind of thing, but it's interesting that they, and usually that's watered down to the common, lowest common denominator, that the people on the further left water down their perspectives to go in with more Labour Party, Green Party types. This was the reverse of this, where the more radical of the left took the leadership and the others came in behind it. That's a significant lesson potentially for Ireland, and let's see what happens if they were to take power and Mélenchon was the Prime Minister. You would be taught, it would certainly have massive repercussions throughout Europe, you know.
Best of luck to them as they go to vote this weekend.
How do you say best of luck in French, Aoife?
Bonne chance.
Bonne chance. Bonne chance.
Bye-bye.
Au revoir.
Merci, au revoir.
As always, a big thank you to Mick Wallace and Claire Daly for the use of this material. Keep on listening to TRP.